The Viridian Nutrition range of 200-plus award-winning products includes vitamins, minerals, herbs, nutritional oils, specialty supplements, tinctures, and balms, all formulated to be healthful, efficacious, and pure. By choosing our Viridian Nutrition range, you are one step closer to your goal of 100% wellness. Ethical vitamins with an organic heart. Available at all Browns outlets. Browns and you.
Welcome, Helga Alul, to the She Warriors, ordinary women with extraordinary stories. I believe that every woman has a story, but some are more ambitious and adventurous than others. I've had the pleasure of sitting down with Helga Alul and listening to her extraordinary story before, and it's always a journey that has left me speechless, in awe of Helga, and always drives me to do more, inspires me in every way imaginable. And this is why I've asked Helga Alul to join me as one of the guests of the She Warriors, because we all need to be challenged and inspired by other women, to aim higher, to be motivated to be the best that we can be. Helga's journey is not only an outstanding career story, a breathtaking personal tale, a story of a woman travelling thousands of kilometres to help build one of the toy industry's biggest success stories in a country she'd never been to before. But this is also the story of a daughter, a mum, a wife, an ambitious employee, a CEO, a company president, an entrepreneur, a mentor, an adventurer, a philanthropist, and a feisty young lady who didn't compromise and didn't take no for an answer, who's pushed boundaries at every stage of her life. Helga, it is an absolute honour to be sitting down with you, an absolute pleasure. Did I miss anything out about you in the introduction there?
No, I think you put me at all. Because I think the first sentence was important. I'm an ordinary woman.
And I love that about you, because this is really what The Warriors is about, is that, you know, it really is the strapline. Ordinary women with extraordinary stories, and yours is an extraordinary story. And I want to start right at the very beginning.
Okay.
I'd love to ask you a little bit about your childhood before we dive into this journey that brought you here and to these incredible things, because you are German.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming grew up in Germany, Bavaria, if I'm correct?
In Bavaria, yes.
Okay.
In Nuremberg, yes.
Tell me a little bit about that. What was growing up All in right. Germany like? What was your family like?
All right. I grew up in a very conventional family. My father was a civil servant, my mother a housewife at home. My father, very old-fashioned, but a brilliant, brilliant dad. I have a younger brother, just 1 year younger than me. And I think we had a brilliant childhood. We didn't have a lot of money, but my parents had time for us. We went out for picnics. We went out with friends. My mother being a housewife, and at the time when I grew up, it was just after the war. I was born in 47. So a lot of my school friends, actually, when you look back, very sad, were children with a key around their neck.
Okay.
Because they had nobody at home. The father didn't come back from the war. The mother had to work. And my mother, being at home, always said, bring them. Don't let them go at home on their own. You know, whatever we had, we could share. If anything, it was spread on the bread instead of a lot of fancy thing, hot chocolate. So we always had a very open house, and my mother was a real mummy, you know, baking, cooking, you know, loving it all. So I had a very good childhood. The one important, I think, person in my life really was my father. I was very much my father's child. I was the elder one, very much a tomboy when I grew up. But he always installed in us the sense of honesty, accepting your mistakes and living up to it. So if you did something wrong, nothing wrong, but live up to it, apologize, or own it. You know. So he brought all this sense of honesty and believing. He as well always said, whatever you want, you can do. Now, I loved school. I really enjoyed school, and it was as well always a bit of a problem because as I liked school and was actually not bad at it, but a bit of a nerd in that respect. So my friends, you know, I was too nerdy. The teachers loved me, but I wanted my friends to love me. So I tried to be naughty, to be on their wavelength, you know, yet enjoying school. So I had a really lovely childhood. The problem was then more of what to do. And I really had no clue after school. I was very good on the math and physics and science side, but I was as well quite good on arts. And I loved painting, I loved drawing and all that. So I said, I want to go into this direction. Staying at home, not knowing what to do, my father said, no, can't go on like that. So he found me a job with one of his friends in one of the company, first company I worked. And I had to go to this office, something I thought I would never do. So I arrived in this office, obviously from school, thinking I know it all. They said, you know how to type? I said, no. But why? I learned it, boom, you know. But we were as well, it was a company who had a lot of young interns, so we were a light clicker of interns. So we got on well, and I must say, I enjoyed it. I had a very tough boss who really put me on, and then the top guy came down and dictated me something, and I had to write it. But I managed it all. And then, in fact, I left this company and went to another company where I was in the accounts.
I'm going to just pause there for a second because you mentioned some incredible values that you learned from your family and from your father and your mother. And I think this is something, as you were describing them now, about the honesty, about opening up, about when you make a mistake, about the family values, about sharing your home with the other children around you. And even that, when you talked about that, and I was thinking, you mentioned about post-war and these young children not having fathers and so on. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is Helga that I know. These are values that you've carried with you all your life, no?
Yes, I think it shapes you. Obviously, I think your upbringing is the most important part because it shapes your value. All right, once you grow up, you change and you evolve. But deep, I think that's the core of you. And I mean, I always say, I mean, what my father taught me, even now getting older, even more it comes back with my grandchildren, what he used to tell me, you know. So you repeat again, you know. He was an incredible man, I must say. And I always enjoyed that I could be with him. As well, I could show him all my weaknesses, my strengths. Mm. I didn't have to hide anything, you know, so.
And also growing up in Germany in that time.
Was not easy.
I was going to say.
It was a tough time. I mean, they have just come out of the war. Obviously, there was this feeling, to a certain extent, this feeling of sadness after all that. But then as well, I saw it from my parents, there was as well this hope again, you know, of redoing something again. I mean, like my parents, we lived in my grandmother's house and my grandfather had a factory. So there was this small factory building next to it, open plan. And they used to do this, carnival parties with their friends around, trying to enjoy, trying to have fun again after the tough times they went through. You know, and I mean, I remember them. We had brilliant time because they always had their friends around. And it's, again, like I said, we had very little money. I remember mummy doing sort of this small hors d'oeuvre, don't touch and don't take one because they were counted, you know, sort of. But there was so much, I think they had to really starting reliving their life again, you know. I mean, the only one thing I regret because it came then much later, when I was older and my parents were older, at the time they wouldn't talk about their hard times.
Yeah.
They just wanted to forget that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And relive a new life, you know, a bit like going out, having fun and all that. And even at school, we didn't talk about the Second World War. It was the time in Germany which was still trying to come out of all that, you know. So it was still thornness in people, sadness as well about it. So even that, it left an impact. But then seeing again the hope people had and trying to rebuild their life, you know, from after what they came out to, it was inspiring too in a certain way, you know. So, no, my father was very instrumental in my whole way, my life really came, because very often whenever I had to take decisions, I said, what would he say?
That's
what
amazing.
Would he tell me?
That's amazing. And so that brings us nicely back into your story, because where we left off was just a moment ago, was where you had your father set you up with a job. You didn't know what you wanted to do. You said, I didn't want to work there. So you went to work somewhere
else. Would I ever work in an office? And then I actually enjoyed it, I must say, you know. Then you get to, I had, as I said, a very tough boss, but on the other hand, he was as well mentoring me, not even me realizing how he was mentoring me. So I did enjoy it. But then I went to the second job, which was in accounts, and then I realized it's definitely not my area. It was just so boring for me, you know. I mean, very nice company. And that's when I left that job, really. I went to Playmobil.
Let's start with this, because this is the most extraordinary story. You have this exchange with Mr. Brandstetter. Uh-huh. And this is life-changing. So you've gone to this company. Please guide me through, because it is an epic story that I think everybody should hear.
But I think my real change really started when I started with Playmobil. Then, I mean, Brandstetter at that time, because I was 20, I think 20. And my boss, the owner, then I was 34, so young as well, thinking back, you know.
Yeah.
And we had, I think, I don't know if I told you that, we had a big clash. I mean, it was a job, I did it, I got my paycheck, but I wasn't career-oriented, contrary to what people think. I was still much more on painting and doing things, but that was sort of to get my living, you know? And then I met this boss of mine, so I was working there, bit bored and whatever. And then one of the girls left and he needed this secretary. We were a very small company. So you were in the sales department, but you were also his secretary, sort of, you have to smudge it. And I remember his ex-wife at the time, she said, why not take her? He said, this one, she's always daydreaming, staying there. She doesn't really, no, I don't know. Playboyish type of thing, you know, he would pass by his car and sound the horns and things I'm going to say, no, no. So we had a bit of an egg relationship. And then I remember once he came and sat on my desk and I said, this is my desk, why are you sitting here, you know? So he was already, you know, getting on my nerve a bit, thinking he can do what he likes. And then I remember being his secretary, obviously, and everybody was very scared of him. He was a very dominant person as such. And I had to write this letter, and I did it. And I mean, all right, for my sense, I was very good in German, in my language. So I gave it to him, and he said, that's wrong. Wecken is not spelled like that. I said, sorry, I was fed up. I said, that's right, I know it. No. So he phoned one of the other persons, this older person in the office. He said, this one says it's right, but it's wrong. He said, but he's right. No. And from there on, it changed.
Just like that?
It just changed, because I either went up to him and told him, that's it, enough, you know, because I knew I was right. And it changed. He said, if she says it so, she knows.
Intimissimi, the art of Italian lingerie. We believe beauty lies in the little things, in the softness of our fabrics, in every delicate stitch. Crafted to support your body and spirit, so you feel confident, elegant, and effortlessly yourself. More than form, more than function, designed to celebrate you. Visit us at Tower Road, Sleema, Mercury, St. Julian's, or online at intimissimi.com.mt.
Otherwise,
that's amazing.
And it really made a whole change. It made a whole change in him, because he started mentoring me. Took me on his hand down in the production line, showing me all the machines, explaining everything, empowering me, letting me have small projects. I mean, it changed everything. And it changed me in my career because I started enjoying it, starting to get to know, you know, trying to understand everything. So it changed our whole relationship. I mean, he was actually my big mentor. I think in everything I did later in my career was shaped by him. But one of the things which was important, which maybe I learned as well from that, was if you know you are right, you are right. That's it. Nobody should change you.
No. That's an amazing testimony. You know? But okay, so let me just ask you about that though, because you're going up to your boss and you're telling your boss that he's wrong and that you're right. And obviously he calls you out on it and tells somebody else, I think she's wrong. And the other person says, no, actually she's right. Now you said that it changed the relationship completely. Is that a respect thing? Was it just that he respected you? Did he respect you for being right? Or did he respect you for standing up to him?
I think more than anything to standing up to him, I think, because he was so dominant that people were always scared of him. And I think this tiny dot says, that's it. But also that he knew that if I really say it's like that, it means I know it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't. I would say, look, I have to think about it, whatever. So I would never say it's like that if I'm not definitely sure.
For sure.
So I think he appreciated that as well, that I really knew what I was talking about.
But Helge, you were a 20-year-old.
Yes.
And obviously, you mentioned before, a lot of people were scared of him and so on. Where did that strength come from? I'm going to go, as we go through your story, I'm going to keep coming back to this. Where did that strength come from? What were you just stubborn?
I think it was maybe as well. I was a bit fed up in this whole atmosphere, everybody sort of buckling down and whatever. You know, I mean, where maybe as well my upbringing came through. If you are confident in yourself, you stick to it. So I think it was maybe I was so fed up. I said, at the end of the day, I leave, you know? I mean, but yep. Enough is enough, sort of. I think that's where, again, came maybe my upbringing. Stand for yourself, you know, and be that person, I think. But I think for him, it was more that I had the guts to call him out for something which I know was right, you know?
Yeah. And as you said, he then started to change, and it's a whole nother story because, and this is where it gets really exciting, is because at the time, Brandstätter then was looking into Playmobil. Playmobil came from here. And you mentioned that you suddenly became interested. What was the motivation for you suddenly
because
becoming interested?
He showed me, obviously, by mentoring him and taking me around, showing me the machine, showing me how everything worked. I mean, like I said, I loved school. I was always interested in learning things. So all of a sudden he showed me what business is really all about. So that, you know, before it was a boring job. I just had a tiny part of to do routine work. But that all of a sudden opened everything, you know. And then it became very interesting. And it was funny as well. You see, by, for example, I mean, obviously being such a young girl, and then our sales manager left. And we had the toy fair and whatever always, and then customers coming. And he said, all right, you take care of him. You talk to the customer, whatever. And I remember as well, one of them, so this customer comes. He said, I'm not going to talk to her, you know, to him. He said, I want to talk to you. And whatever. He said, look, she is the one in charge and she knows. So he backed me up as well, gave me as well sort of this importance that she knows her job, she can do it well, you know, giving me the confidence I needed as well. You know? So, I mean, he was a great mentor, a tough one, very, very tough, but he had certain things as well I remember so clearly, and I used that very much later on as well, that he used to tell me, if you have to tell me something, if I had a small project or whatever, it has to be a one-pager. That I don't have time to go through a whole novel. So be precise, be thing, and tell me in a one-pager. If you have more underneath, you can put it, but I need it like that. And it's so correct, you know, you learn to be precise to put your thoughts together in the points which you really want to take to get a decision done. You don't need a whole novel. You have to know the novel underneath if you are asked questions. But you, if you would want to put your pitch, you know, like you do nowadays, you need to be very concise and annoying. If people ask questions, you know the background.
Great advice. And I just want to just come back to the putting this back into context, because this was, what, the late 60s, early 70s? I mean, this is...
66, 67, roundabout.
Yeah, unprecedented. This is amazing. This is the beginning of an incredible story. So where does this go from you standing up, learning a little bit about business, representing the company when gentlemen come in, when buyers come in, you being given that confidence? How do we get from there to you jumping in a VW Beetle that's painted with flowers to drive to Malta? There's a big gap there. So fill me in on that bit.
That was as well. I mean, all right, so in my personal life, let's put it like that, certain things didn't go as I had wanted them. And we had, I mean, I was obviously always close working with him, more like his PA and whatever. And we had opened the factory in Malta in 71. And we, at that time, did everything from Germany. So it was literally, we sent material down, they assembled and sent everything back. But we did the payroll, we did the accounts, we did everything. So I knew about it. And as I spoke English, so I was always a bit involved, because at the time in companies, people didn't speak English. I spoke English and spoke a bit of French, but mainly English. So I was very involved in all that. And we had, at the time when the company was set up in Malta, we had a technical man, engineer, taking care of it all. And it was a small setup. I mean, we had some 40, 50 people. And then we said, look, we need to try and get more done in Malta, like the payroll, like accounts, and not try to do everything from Germany, to try and set it up a bit better. And we were looking for somebody to take on this commercial role. And I was with him one evening, we were talking or whatever, because we had a very good relationship. And I said, listen, let me go. I need to get off Germany. I need to get out from my personal issues. I said, let me go. He said, no, you can't go. I need you here, no way. I said, oh, let me go. Let me go for a year. I set it up for you and I come back. Somebody
How
else can
do it.
How
old are you at this
point? I was 26.
You're 26 years, and you've been to Malta before or not?
No, I knew about Malta, but I have never been. No.
Wow.
So I said, let me go, because I need the space. He said, no. So I said, look, you have to give me a chance. You know, I said, I can do it. I do the commercial. I set you up the offices, because I knew some of the Maltese girls who had come for training to Germany. I knew them, because we were all youngsters, and they're all very young girls. So I said, let me do it. And it was a toy fair where we launched Playmobil in 74. Immediately after that, I left. I said, listen, I said, I drive down myself. He knew I had this funny beetle, because I was quite a bit of a hippie, whatever. But we were a very relaxed company, and he loved that style, let's put it like that, because sometimes he would even borrow my beetle. He said, let me borrow your car, because nobody will know it's me. So we had this friendly relationship as well. I said, let me do it. My parents thought I was absolutely mad, even my father, because, I mean, he was very conventional and in his civil servant mentality, you know, going off in a country on your own, you know. And I left. In February, I left on my journey with my beetle. And for me, it was like an adventure, you know, just do something different, get away, you know.
Can I ask you, look, when you describe this, and you've heard me telling this story before, was there not a moment where you said to yourself, I'm not sure I can do this?
No.
Or?
No.
Never?
No, not really. No. It was just adventure. I needed a change in my life, you know, in my personal life. I wanted to do something different. I said, let's break away, you know, get away from it all. No, I was just very positive and going to a different country, seeing a different lifestyle. All right, I thought Malta was different than I came to realize. And no, I don't think so. And I knew deep down as well, that it was only limited, that I would come back and I have a job.
Okay.
So the risk wasn't a very big one. If anything, if, let's say, after a month, 2 months, I didn't like it, I could come back, sort of. So there wasn't that much risk involved, you know. It was just feeling free, doing something on my own, you know.
So what was that drive down from Germany to Malta like? That must have been exhilarating, driving in a Beetle covered in flowers down through Italy to a country you've never been before. You're 26 years old.
It was a nice journey, actually. And I remember it was a time, I don't know, it was 74, where you couldn't drive on Sundays because of petrol prices high. And remember, there was a time you couldn't drive on Sunday. People won't know because of petrol scarcity and whatever, because it was the oil crisis. So I remember I was close to Rome, just outside of Rome, and I stopped in one of these motels, but I wanted to go to Rome, but you couldn't drive on a Sunday, and they were the only people who could drive were the suppliers, sort of the vegetable man and the delivery man. And there was the delivery guy, and I said, are you driving to Rome? He said, yes. I said, can I go with you? So I drove with him into Rome, walked Rome, found a lift back in my motel. I was so, in a way, almost naive, trusting and all, but I only had nice experiences. Somebody was watching over me. But I was so happy to adventure, to be on my own and do something. And then, in fact, I drove down to, and then I stopped in Syracuse. I remember as well, I had so many stories, and I found, you know how it is, I mean, a young girl on its own. So I found this nice Sicilian man, and he showed me the whole arena in Syracuse. And he gave me, today you laugh, and he gave me this, it was a rosary bead with a cross, but I thought it was a necklace. I said, what a nice. So I had all this night. I went on the ferry boat. The captain, seeing me, took me on the bridge, you know, because a young girl on her own and sort of a bit of this hippie type, maybe I was at that time, you know, flower power. I had such a nice journey. And then I arrived in Malta. And that's when a bit, I think, my sunny things got a bit of a temper, because I literally was expecting a Mediterranean island, white, blue, you know, sort of. And then I found, I don't know, I found an island totally different. At the time, 74, it was very, very still influenced the English part. So it was like a colonial setup, very, very English influence, which I didn't even expect. No, so it was a bit of a thing. I mean, they made life at the beginning not easy for me, because I remember as well, I had this German guy, this technical guy who took care, and he told me, all right, put me in a hotel, in Slima, in a small hotel. They were very sweet Austrian people. And he said, now tomorrow come to the factory. Now, I mean, I've never been in Driftmin, Malta, didn't know where the factory really was, but I found my way. But he made life a bit difficult. No, and I mean, then I came into this factory, all right, I knew some of the girls, but I had met them when they were for training in Germany, and I arrived at this office. It's a desk, three girls, whom I knew, and these girls came and said, now, you tell us what to do. I said, me? I haven't got a clue. You have to tell me how things are being done here. I said, I just arrived, I don't know. Now you tell me all, what you are doing, how you are doing it. And from there, I said, you have to tell me things here about this island. No, I haven't got a clue. So it was already, we had a very good relationship. And at that time as well, Malta was very different to the Malta. All right, some of it is still here. But there it was still very open to foreigners. No, so this girl straight away took me home to meet their mothers and their families. So straight away you had sort of a support system around, because the mothers took control. We have to look after this German girl. She doesn't know anything. So I found a lot of help in that respect. But the people, you know, but I mean, even in the factory, so they were going out for rabbit to somewhere, Surrey or whatever. So You want to come? It's in Surrey. I said, all right, I come. Now, I didn't know where Surrey was. I almost, and there was no navigator system at the time. So I almost ended up, let's say, in the rocks and whatever. But I found the way. And the minute I walk in, they say, oh my God, she found it. I said, you don't know me yet. I won't give up, you know. So it was quite a learning curve. It was fun. I really enjoyed it, I must say. Then I remember looking for a flat. We had this Maltese, very, very nice man, showing me around this flat. He said, so I can show you 3 bedrooms. I said, what the hell do I want with 3 bedrooms? I said, no, I don't want. And we go into this flat, you know, velvet curtains, this brown, ugly furniture. I said, oh my God, you know, coming from Germany at the time where everything was olive green, orange, you know, yellow. It was like a shock to my system. So then we finally found this very small flat on the out at the end of Der Spiesch, which had just 1 bedroom, kitchen, bathroom, and a big sitting room. And I said, but it looked horrendous. Again, flowered curtains and whatever. I said, but that is small enough, I can manage. So I took this flat, got some of the boys from the factory. I said, take these curtains. They said, take them? I said, no, I don't want all that, you know. Take all that, though. Me with paintbrushes and whatever. So I had this long corridor, which had no windows. So it looked really dull. So I painted flowers going up. I painted the sun. I painted the stars. It was very, very nice. Then I had in the kitchen this brown mahogany chairs. For me, ugly, so I painted everything orange with white flowers. No, very, very nice. I had an old, no, then. Trudy, there are stories to say. So I said to the girls in the factory, I need a telephone. They started laughing. They said, a telephone? It's a 2-year wait list. That's a 2 years. I will be gone by the night. I need my phone now. So I got a phone, but this old black phone. So I sprayed it yellow because it didn't fit in my color scheme and in my flat. So, and then I met my husband. I came in February. I met my husband in May. So we met when he came the first time to my flat, he said, very unusual. He said, is that yours? I said, no, I'm renting it. I said, I did it all. I said, it was so ugly, believe me. I said, I painted it all. He said, does your landlord know? I said, no, but he should be happy. I said, I made it so much nicer. He said, oh my God, he's going to get the shock of his life.
I was wondering about the landlord there.
I didn't even think.
What did he say? What did the landlord say?
The landlord, then finally after a year, because then I stayed on, the landlord phoned me, but it was a lawyer because it was a Liechtenstein company or whatever. And he said, I've never come. Can I come and see it? So my husband said, now you are in deep trouble. This lawyer turns up, comes in. He says, oh, very nice. I've never seen it. It's really... So I was lucky in whatever I did.
That's amazing.
But I mean, he had his nephews, everybody, all the children came. They said, the nicest flat in Malta.
The nicest, brightest flat in Malta. How wonderful. No, so this obviously elevated your experience and you're getting rid of the brown curtains and so on. But to bring it back to what was happening with Playmobil, because you've come down with the Brandstätter Group who have launched this new toy, this small
lovely
toy called Playmobil, which is what I grew up with and I think everybody in the world knows about. Can you just give me a little bit of context for that before we dive into the rest of your story? But because that's huge.
No, this Playmobil is a story on its own and an amazing story. I mean, a beautiful product. But again, Playmobil was born out of, not desperation, but last minute. The company wasn't doing very well. Oil crisis, and plastic is a byproduct of oil, so the price is shot like anything. So all the toys, because before we did run-of-the-mill toys, not a branded toy, but all of them were very plastic intensive. So they couldn't, with the prices going up, we couldn't afford. So we had a designer in the company at the time. They were called sample makers. And this guy, my boss, he told him, listen, I need a product which is small, not a lot of plastic, but will give me money or whatever. And this designer, I mean, brilliant man, Mr. Beck, I knew him very, very well. He came out with his figures. He said, and he told my boss, Branchley, he said, listen, he said, because we have all made always toys. We make trains, we make planes, we make cars, but nobody, nowhere is a figure, but in real life, a car needs a driver, a train needs a train. He said, something is missing in these toys, and what's missing is the people. So he designed these three figures, and he did it very, very well, because they were 7.5 centimeters. They fit exactly in the hand of a child. So it was all, and I remember seeing the prototype, because there were three figures. One was a German knight, the German coming out. One was the German builder, the craftsmanship, and the other one was an Indian, so we go a bit internationally, the Red Indian. So these were the three figures. And I remember as well the prototype, because they were playing around, and we said all, but with these two eyes and this mouth, shouldn't it have a nose? Shouldn't it have more impression? He said, no, he said, children have imagination. Let them use the image. They don't need it. They will see the figure sad or happy. No. He was a person, an extraordinary person, really. And I mean, Playmobil was like that, his children, really. He remained a child in the way of thinking. He could still think like a child. We all forget that, when we grow up. All these dreams and the fantasy. He could still think like a child and imagine what a child sees. So he was lovely. So we launched it in February when I was there. And I remember, because we were desperate. This was sort of the last attempt. So we showed these three figures, and the toy fairs at the time were fairs for buyers, not the ordinary people. So these toy buyers who you think they would really know. So they came, nobody. What's that? What's that supposed to be? Nobody had a clue. And we had one, it was a Dutch company, Simon, we knew him very, very well. He was one of our good customers. And he came, he said, I love that. I want that. Because at that time they were samples. They were not prototypes. So literally carved out of wood. They were,
oh, wow.
No. They weren't produced. They were prototypes, So he said, I want it. He said, produce them. He said, I give you an order. I think the order was whatever for 10,000 or whatever. But I want them. But obviously, the order wasn't enough to make molds. You needed complete different machinery. Before we had large machinery, you needed small ones, different molds. Molds still are, and at the time were very, very expensive because you need precision molds. So we didn't have enough to really go and go into production. But my boss, as I told you, was a clever, clever man. So he went to all his key accounts in Germany, the Karstadt and the Quelle at that time. And he told them, he said, listen, I showed this novelty at the fair, and I have a client from Holland who wants it exclusive. But before I give exclusivity, you are my key buyer. I want to let you know. The minute they hear exclusivity, they all wanted it. So we had enough to do it. I mean, in retrospect, a very clever idea, because it just played on the human.
Absolutely.
Thing, if somebody wanted exclusive, it must be something good, so we wanted to. So we then started producing, which again was because the company wasn't that well off at that time. So we needed to buy new machinery. We needed a different type of plastic material. We needed new molds. So a lot of investment, which the company didn't really have things. Him going to the banks, no help from there. But he was very lucky. He found a machine company, who said, we'll get you the machines. And you pay it later on rental. So we could start. He had somebody with plastic material as well supporting him. So it was suppliers who supported him, not the banks. In fact, he never, ever went back to the banks. When they used to come and want him, he said, "When I needed you, you didn't. Never, ever will I need you."
That's amazing.
That was in his, he said, "Never, ever will I need a loan or a bank." No. So, I mean, it was quite a difficult time. And it was a time when I was in Malta, but I mean, I used to go back every 2 months, whatever. So I knew what was going on. And that's when it was a decision as well, because the figures were all simple pieces. So they had to be assembled. And when we discussed it, I said, "Listen, that is ideal for Malta because assembly is cheap, lower wages. So we can do that in Malta." So that's why the figure production was straight away done in Malta. So we became the figure company. So obviously then as well, the year was up, the company grew, we needed more space. I had met my husband. So one more year, you know. So, and I mean, I used to go back and forth as well. I still kept my flat in Germany. I mean, I was still thinking I was going back, you know, just extending it a bit more. I was at the time already 29, getting to 30, so had been with my husband all the time, and which was as well a godsend because I was a foreigner. And again, you know, when you come to a foreign country, for me at the time, being a single girl, I mean, you don't go in a bar. At the time, you didn't go in a bar and go drinking. I said, "So how can I make friends? How can I meet people?" So I said, "All right, I need to go somewhere where I find people who have the same outlook as me." So sports. So I joined the Master Sports Club because I said, playing tennis or whatever, I find people I like, you know? And that's when I actually met my husband.
But this is really crucial because...
Because how do you meet people?
Absolutely. You know? Because so many people are moving around the world right now.
Yes.
And you were doing this back in the 60s, 70s. You were moving into a different country. And that the principles are still the same. You have to meet like-minded people.
You have to find out what you like and what this being in this country and this area. So you can find people who have the same outlook, the same ideas like you. So you find friends. You
know? Yeah.
I think it was very important that I did that, because otherwise, how do you meet people? And I didn't know the mentality and the people and all. So, I mean, it was very, very important.
Can I ask you, was that a conscious thought? Did you say to yourself, "I need to meet people, I'm going to go to sports"?
It was conscious, yes. I was thinking, I said, how do I meet the right people? You know, I mean, I can't just go walking in the street, you know. So I it was conscious, you know. I wanted to go somewhere where, and a friend of mine, a business friend of mine, Maltese, had taken me to the Martha with his family.
Yeah.
So I liked the atmosphere. There was a family atmosphere, you know, there were children. So I said, no, that is something where I feel safe, I feel good.
Because it applies to so many areas of our lives. Because you could take that thought that you had and apply it to so many areas. If you want to be around people that are good for you, go to the place where those people are at and consciously choose.
It's an important one, you know. I mean, if you love painting, go and get in the art class. Or, you know, I mean, do something where you know. But the mother appealed to me as well because of the family atmosphere there with children running around, you know. I liked it. I felt safe in this atmosphere as well, you know.
So coming back to what was happening in your career, so you've now decided that a year has gone on to another year, to another year, and I'm assuming you decided to stay with your now husband.
Then came a very important decision in my life, because then, I mean, I was getting to, you know, how women are. I mean, I always loved children, and I always knew I wanted children. So I said, I want a child. And now, my husband, a very, very Maltese in that respect, you know, brought up very Catholic and thanked Aloysius and all that. No, I mean, can't be, you know, can't have a child, and we are not married. What, you take the child, you go to Germany? No. Out of question. No, we weren't even talking about marriage. I mean, I didn't want to get married. It wasn't on my radar. I just felt, you know, that slowly I have to decide if I want a child. At that time, 30 was already.
Yes.
Supposed to be older. Now, I mean, things have changed. But, I mean, all my friends already had children, so this need was all of a sudden over-consuming it. But not, and I thought he's a nice guy, so but not marriage or whatever, or plannings. And come the Christmas, I find all of a sudden this ring. I said, well, what's that? He said, you can take it as you want it, engagement or not. Because I think he was as well.
Oh, my gosh.
So and then we said, all right, then, I mean, shall I get married, shall I not? That was, I think, one of the most important decisions I ever had to take. And at that time, it was marriage. And, I mean, today, things are different. But at that time, if you want a child,
yeah,
you know, it for me, or for him, it had to be marriage. And for me, it meant Malta, because I knew he loved the island. I knew he would not just uproot and go back to Germany with me, and I don't think I would have felt good in doing that to him. I loved my job here. The company was doing extremely well. I enjoyed it, you know, enjoyed working. And we, my husband and I, had always had a very good open relationship. We're very honest. I mean, from the very beginning, and then, in fact, when it came to this decision, you know, to get married, I told him straight away, I said, listen, I want children, but if I can, I want to work. And I want my independence. I don't want to be at 6 o'clock, dinner has to be ready or whatever. I don't want that. No, I said, I want to make it very, very clear that I want to have my own personal freedom. You know, I want to be independent. I was very lucky that his mother was a businesswoman, so he grew up with women in business. His sister had a company, his mother was a businesswoman, so he understood that. He said, no problem. He said, there are some things. I said, I want my social life. I want to invite my friends. So if we can combine it all, we'll manage. No, so but we were very honest with each other from the very, very beginning. No, so...
Do you mind me asking, as I'm listening to you talking, Helga, I can't help but think that the way that you describe yourself and your journey and your thought process, particularly in the context of when we are talking about, would have been very unusual. It would have been very bold. It would have been very non-conformist. You were a tomboy, you went into work, you said, yes, I'm going to jump in a Beetle, you come to Malta, you make this work, you argue with your boss, you tell him that he's wrong, you come to Malta, you decide that you want to have children but not necessarily interested in marriage, and then you tell your husband-to-be, actually, you know what, I want to keep this independence. But it's one of the reasons that I asked you about your childhood, because I remember you saying this before, that your parents were very traditional. So where did this come from? This is a very different attitude.
To be honest, I don't know, because as I said, we have a very traditional family. And I think deep down, my mother could never really understand me. She was a lovely mother, but very, very different from me. I mean, in fact, when I got married, she immediately said, so now you stop working. I said, no, I won't stop working. Why? He can't take care of you. I said, no, I don't want to stop working. I have my first child, so you're going to stop working. I said, no, Ma. She could never, ever understand that. My father, I think, yes. He could, I mean, maybe in a certain way, I was a bit more. He would have most probably been a very good entrepreneur, whatever. But obviously, what happened during the war and whatever, made him a civil servant. He was an accountant by profession, but he was a very clever man. So I think it was more him in me. But then again, from my mother's side, her father was an entrepreneur, had the factory. So she always used to say, you are like my father. I mean, some genes must have come this way. Because my brother, again, very different to me. He had his own business as well, but... much more conventional. I think I was always a bit, I was like that at school. I was always a bit different, a bit thinking out of the box, doing different things. I think it was just in me. And my father encouraged it somehow, deep down, you know.
The reason I ask is because I'm wondering if this is partially the secret to your success. And we'll continue with the Playmobil story in a second. But being able to be very confident about your decisions and know what you want, as well as thinking about things from a different viewpoint and saying, okay, I need to be still working. I want to, we're going to get married, we're going to have a family together. But being, as you said, the secret of your success with your marriage is to be honest and open with each other. And I'm trying to work out, you have this incredible, beautiful success story, and I'm trying to work out what the secret is.
I think deep down what it was is I exactly knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted it all.
Fair enough.
There I am. I wanted a family, I wanted children, but I wanted my feeling worthwhile in what I'm doing, in my job, being independent, even money-wise, having my own life, a bit of a personal freedom, that I can go in the evening with some friends or I can do this. I needed that to be me. And I think by the time we came as well to get married and whatever, I was confident enough in myself that that's what I want and that's what I'm going for. Obviously, you never know what life will bring you. I mean, you know, I have to take it, but I must have a lucky star above me because everything worked out. But I knew exactly what I want. And I think I was as well, maybe stubborn enough or whatever, that I said, I will not compromise on that. I want to go it now. So with my husband, yes, we were very honest with each other. And I think that's partial our success as well. We have been married almost now 50 years. So that we were, apart from everything else, we were very good friends. We were very open, you know, sis, because love is one thing, yes. It changes over the thing, but this deep down connection that you have a person you can be, like I was with my father, you could be yourself. Mm. You don't have to, with him, I never had to show act like I had to do maybe in other business areas where I had to show confidence or whatever. With him, I could be. I could be sad, I could be unconfident, worrying. And I mean, I would tell him, I said, do you think it's the right thing? Do you think, you know, this comfort which another person gives me. And for him, the same thing. Now, it took him as well a long time because he was brought up in boarding schools. He did a complete different family life to mine. So he wasn't used to that. So it took me quite some time to open him up and tell him, if you don't tell me, I can't be with you. You have to let me in.
Yeah.
No, but I think this working together helped us as well with our children and with everything and building together the life we wanted.
Yeah.
No.
You dropped these two beautiful golden nuggets, and I call them golden nuggets because I think they are, when I hear them, I think they are just absolute beauties that we can all hold on to and we can all learn from. You said one thing. You said about knowing you and what you want. And I think so often through life, we wander around not knowing what
doubt
we want.
Ourselves.
And we can't be happy. No. And we can't be happy in ourselves. We can't ask other people to make us happy unless we know what we want.
Yeah.
And essentially, our own happiness is our own responsibility.
So only you.
Absolutely. And then you were talking about this relationship with your husband where you could absolutely 100% be yourself. And I think by that, again, it resonates with me because being wonderful and successful is one thing, but being vulnerable and being honest is really where true strength in a relationship lies.
I think, and that gave me the strength in my career as well. Now, I would say every good or strong man needs a strong woman, but the other way around too. Yeah. I think that really gave me the support that I, at home, I could be me, I could doubt myself, I could, whatever, go No, but even, I mean, you know, when you make mistakes, when you make misjudgments. But to him, I could tell them, I said, my God, you know, I was naive. I shouldn't have done that, whatever. No, and he would tell me, but rectify it now. Do it better. Now you learn from it. But it, and vice versa, even he, no, I mean, he knew that, for example, he was in real estate, so he would come, what do you think, should we buy that? I said, listen. And he was always a bit sort of the less risk-taking one, you know, very as well. I said, let's go for it. I'll support it, don't worry. You know, I know I can trust you, you will be perfect, but I'll support it. We, between the two of us, we can do it. And we built everything ourselves, literally, you know. So, no, I think without him, I wouldn't have managed it, I must say.
I want to bring back in what's happening with you in the work environment as well.
Okay.
Because along with becoming a mum and making a decision to have a family and being a wife, you're also seeing this extraordinary success with Playmobil. I mean, Playmobil is one of the most successful toy industry stories of all time. I asked before I sat down with you, I asked 20 people, have you had Playmobil?
Yeah,
every single one of them, from ages between my age right the way down to 20-year-olds, could say at some point they'd had a Playmobil toy, which is phenomenal. And so coming into that, I want, obviously the success of Playmobil has a large amount to do with your role as the CEO driving this company forward. How then, and this is so many questions, but how then can I want to ask you, how then did you manage to cope with a successful marriage, a successful role as a mum, and a successful career? Because this today is a question that is challenging so many women, and you did it before everybody else.
It's not easy. And I mean, let's not easy. And I was lucky enough that I didn't have to do it alone. So, I mean, when I see some single mothers, I mean, I had a partner in crime. So I think part of it maybe comes again from my upbringing in Germany with a sort of discipline, because I think you need to be very disciplined again in whatever you do. So for me, it was always Monday, Friday is work. But I mean, for example, I would always make sure that I'm home in the evening and cook and we have a meal together. But then weekends was always family. Mm-hmm. So I would not pick up the phone or only in emergencies. And everybody, I still do it today. You won't get me over the weekend because I'm with my grandchildren. You know, so you need a bit of a discipline. So I, during the week, I gave it as much as I could. But then weekend was family. I had to give my family the time. You know, and as my husband helped out a lot, because obviously he was his own, he had his own company. So he was running around with the children. So even over the weekend, I would take on a bit more and let him play tennis and have a bit sort of his free time, because he juggled it during the week. I always made sure that we had our meals together in the evening. I had no family here because obviously my parents were in Germany. He had, his mother had died very young, and his father was elderly, so we had no family support, so we only had to employ. I was again extremely fortunate because at the time in Malta, you would find people working with you who, it's not just an employee relationship, they became part of the family. And also I had a very, very good maid from Nashar. She was like a nana to my children and would cook a lot sometimes for me, you know, do me things. Then I had a very, very good nanny, again, brilliant, who used to be a nun with the Order line and left the order and then came to work for me. So brilliant nanny. So I was very, very lucky. So because obviously I needed help, you know, I mean, and for me, it was not important that I have to wash the floors or whatever. Important was that cooking I love. So that was my relaxation. And I have a meal with my family and we can discuss our day together and all that.
That's the second time you've said that. You've talked about the importance of having a meal together. Yes. Why?
Because, I mean, we were fighting. I want to talk, I want to say, I want to... I mean, everybody had to tell his story. I wanted to hear what my husband's day was. I had to give my day. My children had to have their day. So it was always a very important time for us. So it was not important if I did the laundry or the ironing, but that was important. And to be honest, at that time, we didn't have the technology we have today. I would make sure I'm at home. If the children are in bed, I would sometimes drive back to the factory, work again till 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, but make sure I have the time with my children. Because that you have to give priorities, you know, and then going back to work. But I had to drive back to Bulebell and work.
Isn't that exhausting? Isn't it exhausting to try and juggle
but
both?
You do it. I mean, you're young, full of energy. I don't think I could do it today. But when you are young, you do it, no. I mean, it was, and I didn't have to do it every day, but when something was on a deadline or whatever, you know, you had to help out. And I mean, I think for me, what was important as well was seeing that what I did, you know, that, I mean, because there's a funny story as well, let me tell you, and I think I have to say that, because my boss being a male, so the minute I was pregnant, oh my God, she's pregnant. No, so he told me, you're pregnant. I said, yes. So what's going to happen? I said, listen, I do not know. I never had a child. I don't know. I said, I don't know what child I'm going to have. I don't know how I'm going to cope. I said, one thing I can tell you. If I can, I want to continue. If I can't, I will make sure I give over properly and find you a replacement. I will not harm the company, but give me an option. Let me see how it all works. No, I mean, my child was born and a week later I was back at work. So, no, and with the second one too. So, I mean, even that, he said, she can do anything. You know, I mean, he had so much respect for it, but he let me do it. He believed as well I could do it, you know. And I mean, then seeing some girls, some managers in our company, females, he said, if she can do it, we can do it. You know, you become a role model.
Yes, and, absolutely.
You know, they said, she can manage it, you know. But I always told them, you have to make sure, first and foremost, that your partner or your husband or whatever is in line with it. It has to be a team effort. Don't impose. No, I mean, you have to make that sure before you even think about it, because not everybody is like that. No, not everybody was maybe like my husband, because I'm telling you, if my husband didn't have it easy, sometimes his friends said, of course, you have to be successful. You know, he, in Maltese society, it was very unusual. And he as a man, but he's a very confident man. He could cope with it. But he needed this confidence because society was not used to it. You know, so I think we learned through a lot. And in a way, we were very ahead of our time. Today, what we did is today normal.
Yes, it is, because society is changing so much and women are more in work and seeking careers than ever, ever before in the passage of human history. And I think that's why I keep delving down into you as a trailblazer for women successful in the work environment, but also dedicated to your family and to your family life and to your husband as well. I've heard you say in interviews before that, yes, you are the CEO of one of the most successful toy companies in the world.
Most important.
But that your role as a mother and wife was more important.
Always, yes.
And I think this is sometimes where we get it
wrong.
For
me, that is actually, even to myself, where I'm proudest of, that I managed both without harming one or the other. I mean, I did a good job at the company, but again, because I empowered and I had a brilliant team and maybe I did the right leadership there, but also that my family was not harmed, that we had a good family life. I mean, I'm telling you, we, till they were 20, We never, ever went on a holiday without our children. Never. Did we have a holiday on our own? My husband wouldn't. No, because that's the only time we really as well had time for them all the way. So we traveled the world with them. The children always said, you showed us the world, thanks God. And seeing now my children literally living the way we lived, because they learned it.
One of the reasons that it just knocks me crazy is because you did this before anybody else. You know, I listened to Tez saying very similar. She's a very close friend of mine. She's been in TV. She's a teacher. Her and her husband both work. He's in property. She's a teacher and she's an actress. And she tells me that she couldn't do what she does if it wasn't for this partnership and being equal. But you were doing this in a Catholic country before anybody else was doing it. And that's why I'm asking, because I don't think that it changes. That's why I came back to asking you about sitting there, you know, making sure that you have dinner together, because those still have to be important. That still has to be the same value. You know what I'm saying?
We still do it today. You see, I mean, like, for example, we always used to go every Saturday. We go because my son was at St. Aloysius, so they have school on Saturday. We picked him up. And Saturday was always the day we eat out somewhere and we go shopping. Sunday was always a day at home when the grandpa came and whatever, and the aunts and uncles, because they need a whole family, just you know, so I with the whole family involved as well. So this was always at home. Till today, our children would phone on a Friday, what are we going to do tomorrow? Where are we going? With all the grandkids, and we are out on a Saturday. Sunday, if it's a nice day, they come home. We still have that, and they want it, not we impose. If they don't have time, if they have friends, we always say, you have your life. But we're still very close-knit, you know. And the children feel it, even my grandchildren, they feel it when you have this family connection, and it's so important. And that, I think, when you said way back how I grew up, my mother opening her house, having all these children, the family atmosphere, I think that's what you have deep down. No, and family is important. Your career is very important. But once your career is over, a few years later, you're forgotten. But what you always have is your family.
I love that. I absolutely love it. And that is the very reason why I wanted to look at your early years before we talked about your success. I want to touch on the success for a second, because I keep coming back to this idea of you being a very strong, courageous, adventurous woman in probably a time where that would have stuck out like a thumb. I mean, people would have noticed you being, no, I'm going to do it my way. Your boss certainly did. And I think for women today, we get very easily labeled stubborn, difficult, she's a problematic, because women want to do what you did and encounter resistance.
No, I had that very much so, because obviously people have an impression of you. So seeing me successful, they think I'm this strong, powerful, most probably poor husband of hers or whatever. But I had most criticism, and that at a time when it was also difficult for me, because I wasn't so confident if I really did the right thing, was being a mother then. Where other women would say, but you are not really a mother. You are not at home. You don't know the school teacher. You don't know the homework all, because I didn't know all these details. And it used to make me feel very, am I doing the right thing with my children? Are they missing out? We had this conversation even with our children when they were a bit older, you know, and they said never, never. They never missed out on anything. They were always proud of me. And when it was important, I was there, or my husband, one of us always. But this criticism from other women used to hurt me a lot, because I think they couldn't understand me, or they would ask silly things. So you cook? I said, of course I cook. And what do you think? You know. And I had this problem as well because of my career and of my work. I didn't have, at that time, it was even different, that women didn't work. So they had their social network, their coffee mornings or whatever, or meeting at the grocer. I didn't have this connection. And I remember in our neighborhood, there were children more or less like our kids. And so I said, I remember, I told my husband, I said, I have to meet the other women. I have to meet the neighborhood because I don't meet them shopping or whatever. So we used to do a summer party, get everybody in, trying to, again, know the other mothers and talk to them. And that was not easy, to get this friendship with other women. Because for them, I think I was so different that they couldn't understand me. You know, I, deep down, was a mother like them. I could understand them.
Can I come back to this? Helgi, you've just said something that's really blown my mind. You were the CEO of a multi-million euro company, right? You have been president of the chamber. You have set, you've been an entrepreneur. You have been a philanthropist. You've been all of these incredible things. But the one thing that made you question yourself...
was other women.
Oh, good grief. Other women and the role...
At that time. I mean, right. I think it's easier now. I think now with modern women, they're much easier. But at the time, don't forget, Malta was still very much... if you get married, you have to stop working. You know, it was still this old. So most of the women didn't work. You know, they were always at home. They met each other. They knew each other. Their whole life was the school and the homework and the children. And, you know, I mean, even our children, I mean, we had a property next to us. So we made them like a club where all their friends could come. And I know where my children are. And meeting the other mothers. The man, I never had problem. So, I mean, and even, honestly, Rudy, even in business, I sometimes think women do not support each other enough. I feel so let down when you see the network of men and how, even critical, but how they support. And women, we do not support each other enough. We have so much... envy if somebody is a bit better or more successful.
Why?
Instead of, I don't know why. I just, either we still have to evolve because we started much later. I don't know why. We should be far more helping each other.
But does it not come back to, and I've asked this question of myself so many times, and to put, for instance, to put it in the context of, I use this analogy, but if 1% of sports revenue is allocated to women, of sports sponsorship revenue is allocated to women. Women are fighting each other for 1%. And therefore, they're going to pitch themselves against each other. What they should be doing is going after the 99.
Of course.
They should be going after the 99, not after that 1%. But that's perspective. Instead of saying, OK, I'm competing with you, we should be taking on the world. Absolutely. And I think this is
but
where...
it's not happening.
No, and this is where we as women should be...
we need to, yes.
Should,
need
and
to.
This is, again, bringing your career right the way through to where you are present day. One thing I know about you and I love about you is that you mentor other women and you mentor other people and have done that. And I think that is just a phenomenal gift.
I think, truly, we need to say this more and more. That there's understanding outside. You can't say it and... often enough to make changes happening, you know. I always said when I wanted to change something and it sounded a bit absurd to some people, I try to say it to a lot of people until they almost think it's theirs. And then it will happen. No, I don't care if it came from me or whatever, as long as the change will happen.
Yeah. You
know, people have to think forward. I mean, especially now when I see my youngsters with technology, with the changes which should help in happening. People are afraid of AI. And I'm not afraid. We developed AI. We need to see the next step. Mm. But, you know, there is this problem always. People are so frightened of new things instead of seeing the positiveness and then the next step now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And going back to this role that you had as a mum, as a wife, as a CEO, as a building business, as a president of Malta Chamber, all of these roles, you were trailblazing the way for other women. But we aren't ever going to go back. We can't turn the clock back now. So we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep pushing forward. There's nothing else that we can do. And we need to find the right way to go forward. I could, without a shadow of a doubt, sit here for hours listening to you, Helga, but I want to ask some very pertinent questions. What accomplishment in your life are you most proud of?
My kids. My kids and now my grandchildren. My joy and pride.
Why the emotion?
Because, I mean, seeing again, then you give something and create something, because it's what is the life you create, and seeing it evolve in something so good. You know, that's the best thing you can ever have.
You've got me in tears. I didn't expect you to say that. That is absolutely phenomenal. If you could change anything.
Oh my God.
What would and I do change? It differently. What would you change?
What would I change? I think what I would love, that people think much more positive, that people be happier. I mean, laugh more, because life is so short that if we don't enjoy it, if we don't do what we feel happy with, you know, I think when I see sometimes all the pessimistic, then you see the news, only bad news, you know, what we need is much more laughter, joy, happiness, and a fulfilled life.
I love that. Yes, absolutely. And what is the most important lesson that you've learned in this incredible, colorful, adventurous life that you've led?
No, I think for me, the most important thing always, no matter what, is honesty. You never ever lie. You're honest with whatever, even if it's something not very good, but be honest. I think I could never ever trust anybody who is not honest to me.
That's incredible. I have one last question. Helga Alul, what would you want your lasting legacy to be seen as?
I think, again, hopefully to have given some courage to women, but also to be remembered by my children for what I was to them. I don't want a legacy really.
I love you, Helga. Thank you so much for sitting here and sharing these thoughts with us and empowering other women and just coming to this table with such insight. Thank you so much.
You make me cry. You're getting to me into deep thoughts.